You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 9th, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, co-host Nate and I discuss violent right-wing extremism in the United States and Europe, plus the problems with FIFA. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from wvud.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is my co-host, Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
So the first story that we're going to be talking about is another shooting event that happened, except we're not going to be talking about the gun control aspect since we covered that pretty thoroughly last week. We're going to be talking instead about the political angle. So this past Sunday, there was a shooting in a Las Vegas shopping center, which was an act of domestic terrorism. The perpetrators, it has turned out, were radical anti-government right-wingers who had neo-Nazi stuff clearly stated materials present in their apartment, and also that there was that they were tied to the Bundy Ranch standoff, which we'll get to in a moment. This is obviously a story that we had talked about several weeks ago on the show Arsenal for Democracy. And you can read more about this on arsenalfordemocracy.com, of course, but we're going to talk about it here today, their political leanings. So the incident basically was that a man and a woman ran into a pizza shop and shot dead without warning, point blank, two police officers from the local Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and they yelled something along the lines of "This is the start of the revolution" or something like that, and then later yelled "We're freedom fighters," and they also gunned down a random passerby, and then one of them shot the other and then shot herself.
Apparently they also left a "Don't Tread on Me" flag and a swastika on top of the bodies of the police officers.
So, right, so lovely. I think that, yeah, the at the point where they're leaving "Don't Tread on Me" Gadsden flags on the bodies of the police officers, this is pretty clearly an act of political terrorism, even before you get to this Bundy Ranch connection. And I think it is important to call this terrorism. I mean, the last time we did the segment, we had a discussion about when do you cross that line between not terrorist and terrorist, and Nate said, well, when they start shooting, it's terrorism, and these particular breakaway factions,
yes,
started
these are
shooting.
Terrorists.
So these are terrorists. Now, again, that doesn't mean let's make a huge thing out of it necessarily, but as long as everyone's going to freak out about the non-white terrorists and the non-right-wing, you know, terrorists are usually Christian affiliated in these cases, or some extremist strain of Christianity. You know, if they're people aren't freaking out about that in the same way that they freak out about radical Islamic terrorism and other forms of terrorism by non-white people, and that's a problem, because it should be the same. They should all generally be treated the same, which is to address the root causes and to deal with them as criminal enterprises. L. Paul Bremer, who later became the occupation governor of Iraq under the Bush administration and was an ambassador to various countries, he was the top policy official on counterterrorism in the State Department under the Reagan administration. So one of the more conservative administrations you can get in the modern era, and obviously one that many, you know, Tea Party people and stuff are very fond of, maybe through rose-colored historical glasses. But Paul Bremer said, "Another important measure we have developed in our overall strategy is applying the rule of law to terrorists. Terrorists are criminals. They commit criminal actions like murder, kidnapping, and arson, and countries have laws to punish criminals. So a major element of our strategy has been to delegitimize terrorists, to get society to see them for what they are, criminals, and to use democracy's most potent tool, the rule of law, against them." And I think that's a really important point, because too much of the policy in the late 1990s, and then especially after 9/11, has been to treat terrorists, for the most part, as these sort of mythical, destructive figures that have to be hunted to the ends of the earth.
They have basically superpowers, so, I mean, we need to do everything we can to stop them, and that includes, you know, war-like weapons, tanks, guns, planes, missiles, all sorts of fun things like those.
My view, and I think Nate generally shares this view, is let's stop glorifying the terrorists by making them into these superhuman figures. Let's treat them as the criminals and murderers that they are.
I mean, if you look at some of the actual details of like individual terrorists and various attempts or plots that have been foiled, most of them are shockingly stupid. So
right.
Let's stop pretending like that they're somehow, you know, these criminal masterminds. I think they more or less got lucky on 9/11, caught us with our pants down, and you know, we've sort of been overreacting to that ever since. Right. Not that there aren't serious threats out there, but I think pretending like it's a war is definitely counterproductive.
The problem is you can't prevent all of these attacks, but you got to treat these things not as this global warfare front, whether it's at home or abroad. You've got to treat them as these, you know, ridiculous criminal enterprises that they are. I mean, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is clearing millions of dollars a year in extortionary bribes and ransom payments from European countries, governments and companies in exchange for releasing people that they've kidnapped. And that just goes to the point that Bremer made in that document back in the 1980s, which is that these groups invariably commit crimes that are already crimes. They're nothing special about the crimes except that they have these ideological motivations. But we've got to make a decision here. Are we going to treat these things uniformly as ideologically motivated, or are we going to treat some of them as special and some of them as not? And that's the problem, is it starts to break down the rule of law in general if you start applying these extraordinary measures to one group of people and then not to another. It should be consistent, which is why when these things happen and it doesn't fit that mold of what the popular imagination of a terrorist is, I think it's important to point out that these are terrorists, because that helps kind of demystify what's going on in these various attacks. These guys basically, or this guy and this woman, went up to these police officers, shot them dead, and that's an act of terrorism. And yeah, it's murder, but it's an act of terrorism, and it should be prosecuted as murder, or in this case, probably it's going to be prosecuted. Well, it wouldn't be prosecuted because they're not alive, but if they were alive, it would have been probably handled as a standard cop killing. And that's the thing, is it should be handled within these sort of separate frames of mind, because it only just encourages these sort of dramatic propaganda of the deed acts. That's the term from the anarchist movement, where they thought that, oh, if I go assassinate the Tsar of Russia with a bomb, or if I go assassinate William McKinley at the World Fair, that this is going to inspire a mass uprising. And that's what the people yelled in this case, was, this is the start of the revolution.
Never happens.
And it never happens like that, but it encourages more such actions by people who do think that that's going to work. It encourages people to do that more frequently. And if we instead said for all of these, this is an act of terrorism, but they will be handled as standard murder, you know, unless it's a government official, in which case it's a standard murder of a government official, that kind of delegitimizes this propaganda of the deed approach and makes it even less effective and less attractive to people who are potentially going to be engaging in stuff like this. And that's the lesson that I take away from here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that really shocked us about 9/11 was just how it was on such a large scale, and just the complete destruction of two buildings and multiple planes being involved and all of that. And then that was sort of it had the wow factor that really led us all to become very afraid of the prospect of terrorism. And then we, of course, invented all the stuff with Iraq and the possibilities of various chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons being deployed against us. But now, I mean, it seems, you know, just how we're seeing global terrorism in this decade, it looks like the vast majority of the incidents are relatively small, you know, IEDs, bombings, kidnappings, murders, more just personal, in some ways more petty types of crimes, bribery, extortion, things like that. And so it's obviously way easier to talk about it being a law enforcement type operation if those are the things we're dealing with, rather than planes flying into buildings and then the buildings falling down. So, I mean, I think this actually does play into our hands a little bit nicely, in that we're not having, at least for now, to deal with these giant plots, and we're just sort of foiling these more isolated type incidents. You know, hopefully we're never going to have to deal with those things again, but obviously, you know, we still have to be on guard for them. But this is more of a law enforcement type situation right now, especially.
So let's get into the politics a little bit here. You know, in the past, there's been right-wing extremism, there's been left-wing extremism, but that seems to have mostly drifted into the past. For all the talk that got brought up in 2008 about Bill Ayers and the Weather Underground, I mean, that stuff was happening in the 1960s, and kind of, you know, has really dissipated since then. The similar radical left terrorist attacks in Europe that were pretty common kind of petered out in the 70s and 80s. And so mostly what we've seen now is this sort of concentration of these domestic attacks around a far-right ideology, which is obviously not held by the mainstream conservatives or mainstream Republicans. But the problem is that within the Republican Party and within the conservative movement, there is incorporation of this fringe in the United States. And that does pose a bit of a problem. And there hasn't been enough repudiation. Moreover, a lot of the repudiation seems to come in the form of just trying to say that there's no connection whatsoever here. And the reality is that there is a connection there. You know, a lot of it's taking some of the positions to their extreme endpoint, but also it's just that there is, you know, when you have the party willing to take kind of lighter versions of these anti-immigrant policies or rhetoric, you know, self-deportation and things like that, you know, if you say, oh, we want to make it as miserable for the immigrants to be here as possible so they'll leave, I mean, somebody's going to take that then to the next step and say, well, let's help the process along and things like that. Now, in this case, it didn't involve that.
I mean, that's a logical step, Bill. I mean...
So what we see in these situations then is that somebody just goes all the way with it. So in this case, it had to do with the Bundy Ranch standoff. This shooting happened in Las Vegas, and as we discussed previously on the show, the standoff there happened a little bit outside of Las Vegas in the state of Nevada on public lands. And what it seems like is that these particular shooters who were ejected by the people at the Bundy Ranch, I guess to their credit, the people who were involved in this shooting here, their position was that they got tired of waiting around and they wanted to shoot some government officials, and they didn't like just pointing weapons threateningly at them. And so this was their grand plan, was that they were going to go shoot some government officials and put some "don't tread on me" flags on them and that sort of thing. And according to the reporting done by the Las Vegas Sun, quote, "residents who spoke about the Millers all mentioned the couple's relationship with Bundy. Oak Tree resident Sue Hale said the two told her they were in Bunkerville during the standoff, which occurred in April after federal authorities began conducting a roundup of Bundy's cattle. Bundy had defied the government by grazing the cattle on public land without a permit." She said that, quote, "they were always running their mouths about the situation there." And furthermore, the Las Vegas Sun says, "after killing the officers, the couple covered their bodies with the cloth displaying the Gadsden or Don't Tread on Me flag, Revolutionary War era symbol that has been adopted by the Tea Party. Investigators also found swastikas at the suspect's apartment." So the Bundys saying there's no connection, saying that they kicked them off. But if you look at the social media posts from these people, you know, they had said that they had been kicked out of the ranch, that, you know, one of them had a felony conviction, and the Bundy people and their supporters didn't want to be made to, you know, they looked bad. And this really leads into this fundamental issue, which happens anytime any of these happen, which is you can try to distance yourself, but you got to look at the relationship between the words that you're advocating and then the actions that some people take them to. Are you in fact inciting some people who maybe are unstable or something, or susceptible to these pressures? Are you putting out rhetoric that they're going to take to that next level? And in fact, even within the outright hate group movements, you know, far divorced from the Republican Party or the conservative movement or anything, the actual out and out white supremacist groups, they say the same things when someone does an attack, right? So if someone goes and kills a bunch of people as a white supremacist attack or blows up a building or something, they also say, well, I never told anyone to use violence. And it says, well, you used violent rhetoric for years and basically planted the seeds in their head, and then told them, don't connect us back to you if you do anything. It's a very deliberate strategy. And in this case, I would just be wary about the idea that they're distancing themselves from this. Of course, they're going to distance themselves from it. But it gets into that issue of what's incitement versus actually committing violence.
Yeah, Bill. And there was a couple quotes that came out from Bundy shortly after our last segment on him. I wouldn't necessarily say these are inciting violence, but I think they do reveal a little bit into Bundy's mindset. He talks about seeing a public housing project in North Las Vegas and just people sitting around, half a dozen people on the porch. Obviously, these are black people. he's talking about. And later in the quote, he said, they were basically on government subsidies, so what do? They abort their young children, they put their men in jail because they never learned how to pick cotton. I guess that, just throwing that in out of nowhere. And I've always wondered, were they better off, are they better off as slaves picking cotton, have a family life and doing things, or are they better off under government subsidy? They didn't get no more freedom, they got less freedom. And shortly after that, a bunch of Republican senators, including Dean Heller and Rand Paul, who had previously sort of supported Bundy's stance against the Bureau of Land Management, they sort of just had to come out and say, hey, we don't support those appalling and racist statements, and we're just going to back off now. So we basically alienated some of his mainstream support with those quotes. I mean, this is, we've heard these, basically these exact same quotes from a lot of different sources over the past couple of years, somehow trying to basically say, hey, at least people were given food during slavery, so therefore it's cool. I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this last quote. They didn't get no more freedom, they got less freedom. I'm pretty sure if someone's a slave and then becomes not a slave, that's a net gain of freedom, just almost by definition. If you're being given money in the form of government subsidies, I mean, yes, you can have this like abstract philosophical argument how that makes you a slave to the government. Oh, no. But I mean, that's not the same thing as having chains around your wrist. So let's not even start with that.
Right. I think there's this perception, misperception, that American slavery was just super low wage employment, as opposed to, you know, because that, well, you'll hear
in
these
nice big houses,
right? You'll hear these Duck Dynasty type guys or Clive and Bundy talking about, you know, oh well, they got their housing provided for them and they got their food provided for them, and so clearly they weren't, you know, they were getting paid. And it's
bet there were just like big feasts up at the manor house, and everyone was invited to join in, and they got the best highest quality food and clothes, and they probably slept, you know, they had their own personal bedrooms inside the manor house. I'm sure it was just great, just lovely.
And it's just, it's this crazy refusal to recognize that this was chattel slavery, where your physical freedom of movement is legally restricted and you are nothing more than property. You have no more rights as a person than the person who owns you, that their horse has or something, right? You
like can a share of stock or something.
Yeah,
like
you can
hold on to it until the asset is not good enough or it's not making you the money you want, and then you sell it off somewhere. And then, I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not people. Like,
right. It was completely.
How can you say you get less freedom because you're being given money by the government in the form of a subsidy because you're unemployed or something? It just makes no sense.
Right. And it's so mind-blowingly wrong. And, you know, I think that there's a lot to do with this.
I like how he just throws in the never learned how to pick cotton thing out of nowhere, as if that's the only thing that black people are good for is picking cotton.
Well, that and that the idea that this was, that again, this was low wage employment, but there was jobs training involved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Real good job training.
Right.
Applicable in the 21st century.
Yeah, the problem is that there's this sort of warped like ideology that of how things used to be, and that we have to go back to this time. Now, a lot of it he just makes up. I mean, last segment we talked at great length about his bizarre theories of how Nevada was actually not subject to federal jurisdiction or whatever, and he didn't recognize the existence of the federal government,
to save the tortoise, the desert tortoise.
Yeah, he had to save the desert tortoise. But the other thing that happens here is that you get these just so ahistorically creative fictional universes. Obviously, the slavery myth stuff is one of them, and that's perhaps the most destructive. But then there's just all these other strange things. For example, this is a direct quote from Clive and Bundy referring to the Pilgrims. They had a central government, which was Europe, was the strongest army in the world, and they ruled with unlimited power.
England did not have the strongest army in the world at that time.
And there was a point that they decided they wasn't going to live that way anymore, and so they had a revolution. Which he's now constricted down the entire history of the Pilgrims from 1620 to 1776. He's he's mashed that all down, combined all of the governments of Europe into one thing. And this is during the period when all of Europe was fighting in the 30 Years' War, right before the English Civil War, when all the reforms were made to make England have an actually credible army.
I mean, 30 Years' War was probably one of the most destructive wars by percentage of the population killed in all of human history.
Right, and that was a bunch of armies fighting each
basically
other.
Basically the First World War, before there was
any
World Wars.
Yeah, and it was also a way of fighting over who had sovereignty and all these other great things, right? There was, in no way was there a unified Europe world government with a giant army, and that's why the Pilgrims left.
Didn't a greater percentage of Germans die in that war than World War II?
I believe so. I think it was one-third of the population of Northern Germany was killed during the 30 Years' War.
So, I mean, Europe, it's all the same.
Right. And so,
but I do like the, maybe it was about just they had a central government in Europe. I mean, because there was like some socialism involved.
Right. It's a central government, which was Europe. That was his line.
Not really.
Except there was no part of that was correct. But yeah, so this is a man who's trying to argue based on an arcane and incorrect legal theory that the federal government can't make him pay to graze cattle on federally managed public lands. He literally believes that the 1620 Pilgrims had a revolution and flat earth sailed to America because they needed to escape a totalitarian government that ruled over all of Europe with a massive army. And somehow, despite a total lack of knowledge on the country's actual history to that point, to the point of not knowing the facts that the rest of us learned in like fifth grade, he's considered to be a patriot. And then all these people show up. I mean, these shooters in Nevada claimed that on social media that they had sold all of their belongings and moved to Nevada so that they could permanently help out in this glorious standoff against the federal government, and then end up just shooting some cops in the back of the head while they're eating pizza.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he's talking about black people freeloading on government assistance while he's refusing to pay his
millions of dollars in back fees,
grazing fees and all that. I mean, just a little ironic.
The problem is that a lot of this extremism has just gotten wrapped up into this whole big thing, this sovereigntist movement and this nationalist pro-white, but not openly saying pro-white movement.
It's bubbling under the surface a little bit.
It's all there and it's all interconnected, and it all ultimately is going to tie back to certain ideology. I mean, you even look at the so-called Reagan Democrats, right? And a lot of them are in the South or in various areas of the Northeast and more rural areas. And those so-called Reagan Democrats basically aligned with Reagan because they decided that the Democratic Party was getting too black. And some of them are still registered as Democrats. So periodically you'll see after something like this happens, you go, oh, well, that guy was actually a registered Democrat. And it's like, okay, he's a registered Democrat because he apparently never changed his party affiliation. But the rest of the party moved away from, for the most part, from those overtly nationalist positions and all that. And you know, no state is immune from this. It's come and gone in every part of the country. There, you know, in Massachusetts, for example, before the Civil War, had a period where the so-called Know-Nothings, the nativist party, or the very insultingly named Native American party at one point, which was basically anti-Irish for the most part and some other anti, you know, different ethnicities of Europe coming in, they won the state legislature in Massachusetts at one point. There was an election where they came in first with a plurality of the seats in the state legislature in Massachusetts. So this kind of thing has happened everywhere, but there are certain areas where it's all getting really blurry. And these are either the areas that have had this long, tenuous love-hate relationship with the federal government in the Mountain West, or this generally ongoing hate relationship with the federal government, excluding defense contracts and things like that, in the Deep South. And the problem with the Deep South, though, is that they have that legacy of chattel slavery on the plantation that's not found elsewhere. But some of that is then blurred out across the Mountain West and mixed in with these sovereigntist anti-governmental ideologies, like Bundy expresses, and eventually some people aren't just content to wave around guns. Sometimes they're going to go and attack government figures and try to assassinate them. And that's the problem. You got to be careful about the power of your words. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me this week is Nate. Nate, we're going to talk now about FIFA and the World Cup coming up in Brazil, as well as the upcoming World Cups after that. Take it away.
Yeah, Bill. I mean, just wondering, are you planning to watch any of the games at all, or just US?
Probably not. I can't remember the last time I watched a soccer game.
Oh, that's a shame. I'm just remembering back in the 2006 World Cup, studying around for finals and stuff, and just I remember going home and watching the games just after school. And then, you know, the last World Cup was great. And, you know, I think this World Cup, the U.S. is in the group of death, but, you know, we do have a shot to squeak through, so that's going to be exciting. And there's a lot of real quality teams out there. You know, a lot of players have been injured, so that's kind of deflating. Marco Reus just picked up a ACL injury basically in the last training game before going to the World Cup, which is just heartbreaking to hear as a, you know, Germany sort of being my second team. But, you know, there's just been a lot of stuff swirling around the World Cup recently. Problems with the construction of stadiums in Brazil. Bill and I have talked about off the air about how just there are all these massive protests going on. There have been police clashes recently, you know, tear gas type situations with some protesters who are upset about, you know, just all the money that's being pumped into building these stadiums, many of which the stadium got built, but, you know, all the stuff surrounding it was not built at all. And how, you know, they're building these stadiums basically in the jungle, you know, where they have to float all these supplies down river. And, you know, they're just pouring all this stuff into the local communities, but it's not really going to just the ordinary people. It's sort of just a lot of the money is, I guess, just going to some of these contractors and construction agencies, things like that. There probably should be a boost to the economy with tourists coming in for the World Cup, but it just seems like there have been some massive problems with this World Cup. You know, hopefully it goes smoothly, but it certainly hasn't gone smoothly just in the run-up to it. But the real issue we want to talk about is the future of the World Cup. And the next two World Cups, as of now, are scheduled to be in Russia and then Qatar. And, you know, I can't think of two worse countries to hold them in, honestly. Maybe, you know,
North Korea.
I was going to say maybe like somewhere Antarctica, or, you know, somewhere where you just can't play football. North Korea, some repressive totalitarian state, maybe have them in like Iran or somewhere. Although, honestly, Iran might be an upgrade over Qatar. So, I mean, two things that have come out recently. Obviously, we've heard of all the problems surrounding the surrounding Russia and its persecution of just everyone, apparently, Ukrainians, gays, everyone. And so, you know, we've talked about the Olympics, we've talked about all that. So we sort of covered the problems that would engage in Russia. I mean, at least they have stadiums. It's a big country. They'll have enough stadiums. And Russia will do what Russia does to industrialize and, you know, all that. So we're not as concerned about Russia right now. The big thing is swirling around Qatar, which is a nation in the Middle East. And during their proposal, their bid for the World Cup, because you have to submit bids and tell the World Cup, tell FIFA, which is probably one of the most corrupt organizations in the world, how you're going to pay for all this, how you're going to construct these stadiums. Basically, Qatar said that they were going to build a bunch of outdoor stadiums and they were going to air condition them against the summer heat. It gets up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit with regularity in Qatar, and they're building outdoor stadiums, which they say they said they're going to air condition. Then they had to come back and said, actually, turns out we can't really do that because it's impossible. So they basically built all these new stadiums, or they're planning on building all these new stadiums where it just can't happen. All this stuff has come out. The Sunday Times has done some good reporting in England, basically about how this guy Mohammed bin Hammam was, you know, centered around all sorts of bribery towards FIFA, basically bribing of a fair amount of both voting and non-voting members of FIFA. I guess primarily non-voting. Bill, read a bit about the story too.
My understanding was that the current allegations reported by The Guardian, who's also been doing a lot of good reporting on this, was that Qatar's strategy was to bribe non-voting officials from Africa to generate enthusiasm for the bid so that it would look like there was an organic groundswell of support for it without actually bribing the people who were going to vote on it.
Okay, so they sort of did it in a sneaky way. And, I mean, they are trying to bring the World Cup to a more global audience, and, you know, they just had one in Africa bring it back to Brazil. And I guess this is sort of in line with they're trying to spread the game now to the Middle East. But it just seems like this has been a terrible, terrible disaster. Just thinking about the prospect of playing in, you know, 120 degree Fahrenheit temperatures, that's going to be, you know, if we thought playing in the Amazon was bad, it's probably going to be even worse, just playing in the desert. And now it seems like we're reaching a critical mass here. Several of FIFA's headline sponsors, basically, the you know, we'll be seeing a ton of these commercials in 2022 if this goes off. They've said that they want to look into the corruption allegations. So Visa, Adidas, Sony, Coca-Cola, Hyundai, massive, massive multinational corporations are basically saying, hey, wait a sec. Do we really want our brand and our name plastered all over this incoming disaster that just has a potential to piss off everyone in the world of sport and pretty much everyone in general if it goes off badly? And this is before we even get into the talk about basically the slave labor that goes on in Qatar. You think the protests are bad or the problems are bad with stadium construction in Brazil. At least these people aren't being enslaved. I mean, there's right. a lot of situations where, especially Indian and Nepalese migrant workers, and it's not just Qatar, it's the UAE, it's Dubai, all those countries which have a lot of construction going on, in part due to the oil boom, they can't leave. They're there, and basically they're, you know, it's sort of contract labor, conscription, whatever you want to call it, but they're forced to do work, basically, and a lot of them have died building these stadiums, probably due to, you know, lack of proper safety regulations, just poor working conditions, all sorts of stuff, and it could be in the tens of thousands by 2022. I don't know the exact number, and probably it's not being reported correctly just because it's tough to get right. accurate information, but it could be many thousands.
The most recent estimates are that it's on track to result in 4,000 deaths by the time that the World Cup starts there in 2022, assuming it's not moved. So let's do a little bit of background. Obviously, as Nate said, the situation in Brazil is pretty bad. I mean, it's like there's a consistent problem with a lot of these international games and even national games being brought to these areas as sort of an engine for quote-unquote urban renewal, which usually
it never works
usually, and it means bulldozing out the poor neighborhoods and getting rid of those
in China, where they just took out all the slums, and I mean there have just been tremendous problems. I'm not actually against bringing these types of games to countries. I mean, you look at the importance of the just the global nature of soccer, and I think it is important to bring it to other countries. But I mean,
in terms of balance, you need
to do it correctly. I mean, I don't want to see the tournament just in, you know, Germany and France and England every year, but you do want to see it without massive protests or the need to construct a bunch of new expensive stadiums that aren't going to be needed once the World Cup leaves, because it's only there for a month.
Right.
And so
the investments are these basically these boondoggle things that benefit these contractors, as Nate said, and they don't benefit the average people. I mean, Brazil could do with a lot more expenditures toward the lower class population, and instead is spending on a soccer stadium
services,
in the middle of nowhere.
Also,
I mean, but back to Qatar. So as Nate said, yes, they're bulldozing neighborhoods as they are in Brazil, but they're also enslaving people, which is a bit of a problem. So for those who don't know, the country of Qatar, it's about the size of the state of Connecticut. It's an absolute monarchy in the Persian Gulf, an oil producer. Most Americans only know it as the home of Al Jazeera. I want to note that Al Jazeera English, their sort of British version, and Al Jazeera American, both have been doing reporting on the situation regarding the World Cup and the slave labor problem. So they have actually been doing reports on this, in contrast with, some people's expectation that they probably wouldn't cover it.
Well, yeah, Al Jazeera is actually one of the more balanced international news organizations you'll find.
I have no idea if they're covering it domestically, though. But okay, so the country won the bid, as we said, under questionable circumstances for 2022. A lot of the criticism initially was about how hot it was going to be, as Nate said. But then there was the issues over the human rights laws, or the lack of human rights laws. And then more recently, it became this concern over the slave labor. So apparently, hundreds of marginally compensated foreign laborers who are preparing for the tournament have already died. That's why the estimates are projecting out that it's going to be 4,000 on current pace, and based on, you know, various projections of what kind of workforce is going to be needed. Moreover, not only are they not allowed to leave the country without the permission of their employers, which is a, you know, warped form of chattel slavery in the modern era, some of the workers have not been paid at all in the past year and a half. Well, actually, it'd be 2 years at this point, because that was a figure from January. So some of them, you know, were not paid for at least a year and a half to 2 years. And they generally all live in really dangerous packed tenement housing. It's a real mess. Obviously, this problem is more extensive than just the World Cup for this country. The overall foreign worker population in Qatar is more than six times the size of the ruling native Qatari population. The ratio is about 1.65 million to 250,000 people. There's only 250,000 natives there relative to this, you know, well over a million foreign workers. And that foreign population, as Nate said, along with the other Gulf nations, has grown dramatically and sharply in the past few years. So those numbers are a little bit fuzzy. It could be a lot higher, in fact. But due to the oil wealth and concentrating it in the native hands, the citizens there are among the world's wealthiest populations, but they've preserved the wealth by chronically underpaying or even enslaving this huge migrant population. And according to the IMF data, even if the national wealth were distributed annually over the whole population, including non-citizens, everyone would still be making well over $100,000 adjusted for purchasing power. So if they paid all of these workers, these foreign workers, using these oil revenues, everyone would be, you know, would be in the upper middle class by U.S. standards, you know, when you've adjusted for purchasing power. And so that gives you an idea of just how much money those 250,000 people must be making if the rest of the people aren't getting almost any of it, or really any of it at all, in the case of the slave labor. So they've kept their foreign workers, who make the country function daily, in horrid conditions. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, this World Cup situation, because it's clearly such a bigger problem. However, the World Cup does bring all these related problems with FIFA.
And I just saw this as we're coming in to do this show. Sepp Blatter, who's the president of FIFA, had some hilarious quotes in which he said, "Criticism of the corruption claims regarding around the Qatar 2022 World Cup are motivated by racism." He goes on to say, "There's a great deal of racism and discrimination. It makes me really sad." Oh, it just so sad for this guy. I mean, he's only, you know, had the top position for, I believe, you know, almost a decade, and just repeatedly racked by corruption allegations, never gets, you know, caught with his hands particularly dirty or anything.
Yes, Sepp Blatter took office in June of 1998. So as of the day before we record this, he has been in office as the president of FIFA, the eighth president of FIFA, for 16 years. So not a high rate of turnover.
And then they're talking about going at the British media for reporting the fact of some of these corruption allegations. I mean, it's just embarrassing. The fact that you're going with the race card right there. Yes, I'm sure there is some element. You know, everyone knows soccer fans can be extremely snobby, and, you know, just thinking if they're not playing the game in you know, some town stadium in England, it doesn't really count as soccer. You know, constantly denigrate the U.S. game. Or doesn't count as football, I guess. They even hate that word. And so, you know, don't want it to be held in the Middle East. You know, there's a lot of prejudice there. So, hey, I'm sure there's some of that. But, I mean, let's not pretend like this has anything to do with the actual problem surrounding this tournament. I mean, it's a disgrace. And I really, really hope that in the next couple months after this World Cup is over, the, you know, the sponsors, some of which are, you know, just billions of dollars sunk into this, they actually pressure FIFA and tell them, hey, can we do this somewhere else that's not going to make us look terrible? And some of the other bids that Qatar overcame were Australia, Japan, South Korea, and the United States. I would love to see a tournament in Australia. I think that'll be awesome. Just, you know, there's such a great sporting culture there. You know, soccer is not necessarily the biggest sport, but I don't think they'd be particularly wanting for stadiums. They have all those rugby stadiums, and, you know, it's Australia is a place where I don't feel like you'd necessarily have to do a ton of work to build. The only question is, the time zones and all that stuff. So that's one thing. Japan, South Korea hosted in 2002, so it'll have been 20 years. I don't see a reason why we couldn't give it to them again. It's important to grow the game in Asia, and I think those two countries would probably do a good job at hosting it. And then there's the U.S., who we hosted in 94. I think actually soccer, with the growth of MLS here, has actually started to take a real foothold in the past couple of years. We see the transfers of international superstars like David Villa, Frank Lampard, Thierry Henry, and of course Beckham a while back to the United States' league, MLS, Major League Soccer. And I guess, between that and just the overall quality of the league going up, that'll help, just grow a new generation of soccer fans here in the U.S., make us a real country. So I think bringing it back to the U.S. would be perfect. I mean, whether it's just U.S. or we maybe give some games to Canada or Mexico just to make it, not try to make it the U.S. the center of focus, just so maybe it's a little less politically unpopular because, it's the U.S. Not a lot of people like us. But we're not going to have to build new stadiums. We've got millions of college football stadiums and MLS stadiums, soccer, college soccer stadiums. It wouldn't be a problem to host the tournament, and we could probably do it for this World Cup. If I don't know if we'd have quite enough time prepared in the next couple days, but we could do it for the Russia one. We could do it pretty much whenever. And I know the Women's World Cup is about to happen in Canada, which would be awesome. I hope to go to some of those games.
My concern about with the U.S. is that, I guess the stadiums, as you said, we have more of these stadiums available or convertible in the United States relative to, say, the more specialized facilities needed for an Olympics bid. But it seems like the pressure with all of these host things is FIFA somehow forcing all these host countries to build new everything. Right. And my suspicion is that even despite the fact that it would be more convertible than an Olympics bid, it seems like there would be a very high risk that there would be a tremendous amount of pressure on the United States to build all new facilities or almost all new facilities for all these things. And that invariably ends up meaning bulldozing lower income neighborhoods in the United States and continuing to push through these, gentrification agendas and things like that.
I saw yesterday that just someone reviewing the U.S. bid from back a couple months ago when it was all decided that they wouldn't actually have to build new stadiums. And I'm sure there would be costs associated with it, but I don't think it would be particularly massive. In 94, they, let everyone play in the grassy college football stadiums, just modified, I guess, the seating a little bit so it's more apt for soccer. I don't think it would be that high of an investment. Certainly, not nearly like anything we're seeing in Brazil. I mean, I'm not saying it has to be the U.S. I would love to see it in Australia or really anywhere else but Qatar. We're just seeing that it's not. I mean, when you add everything up, slave labor, hot temperatures, just, the problems inherent in the country, just in terms of people from all over the world coming to what is kind of just like a petro kingdom. It just seems like there's so many better places you could do it than Qatar, and they got it blatantly because of corruption. And that, I mean, there are like oil sheikhs that have put a lot of money into football, especially in England recently. You see with the Paris Saint-Germain as well, Manchester City. But we shouldn't be rewarding the influx of money into the game like that by awarding it to a country that doesn't really deserve to have the World Cup, just by their track record, by the things they'd have to do to prepare. I mean, I don't want to get to the World Cup 2022 and then, we find out that, 7,000-10,000 migrant laborers have died, but hey, the World Cup, hey, let's all have fun and watch soccer. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think that would put a pretty big damper on the whole festivities. So something needs to be done with this. It remains to be seen what exactly can or will be done, but I think the fact that all these major companies have started pressuring FIFA is a step in the right direction. FIFA is incredibly corrupt, so we have no idea what's going to happen. But, I mean, this is what needs to happen to get the ball rolling on this. So hopefully we'll make some progress after the World Cup.
All right. Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment with more coverage of different stories. So stick around. Well, Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the European elections. There's a number of possible angles to talk about this. We have a very long article on arsenalfordemocracy.com, a guest post by my friend Etienne Baracco, and he is a national counselor with one of the political parties in France and a friend of mine, and he wrote a post on the recent European elections. Those are the elections for the European Parliament. You know, a number of seats are given out to each country depending on their population. Everyone gets to directly elect the members of parliament within their country who are going to go represent their country in parliament. And then those different parties who get, those people who get elected as members of the European Parliament, then have special parties that are European-wide parties, sort of coalitions, basically, or internal blocks of different parties. So the Party of European Socialists, for example, has all of the mainstream socialist, social democratic, and labor parties from across Europe, and so on and so forth. The big feature of these most recent European elections, as explored in great detail in that article, was the rising populism primarily on the right in those elections. In other words, the centrist parties and the center-right parties, mainstream conservative parties, including the Conservative Party in Britain, losing out big time to parties that were either far-right, nationalist, Euroskeptic, or neo-Nazi. Those are different categories, not all overlapping within the frame of populism, but primarily they were on the right side of the spectrum, which meant that they were taking away votes from those center-right blocks in the European Parliament. Most problematically, in Greece, was the 10% of the vote won by Golden Dawn. It wasn't the biggest vote share, certainly, but 10% is nothing to sneeze at. On the strength of the 10%, they won three seats in the European Parliament representing Greece. Greece is a founding NATO member, although I believe they dropped out briefly for a while, but they were one of the original founders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They have been a very heavily militarized country for the entire course of the 20th century after winning independence because they were up against Turkey right next door, or previously the Ottoman Empire. And they've continued to have a very high emphasis on the military role there, even in recent decades, although less so since the last military regime fell in the 1970s. Greece has also been one of the early members of the European Union. I believe they were one of the founding 12 members of the European Union. And it's very troubling, not just that they've been sending anti-European integration parties in, but that they're sending openly neo-Nazi parties. Now, when I say openly, they weren't so completely open before the elections. They were consistently trying to claim that they weren't actually neo-Nazis, but the spokesperson of the party had a swastika tattoo, etc., etc. However, one recent development that happened in the aftermath of the elections about a couple weeks later was that they started having rallies in the country where they were waving Nazi symbols on flags and things like that and singing Nazi songs with Greek lyrics and various other things like that. Just basically openly celebrating Nazism, which is a bit much coming from a country that was brutally occupied by the Nazis during World War II. But I think that maybe some of these people were sympathetic to that position during World War II, or at least their ancestors were. And this is in contrast with the Greek left that has a problem with the austerity policies of the European Union. This is a party that openly rejects the European Union concept as a whole, and apparently rejects minorities, human rights, freedom, people who don't vote for them, etc., etc. Most of their party leaders are wanted for or being investigated for actual murder. You know, this is very similar to what we talked about in the earlier segment about all these sort of far-right terrorist groups or radical non-right terrorist groups who use extortion and kidnapping and murder as their standard tactics. This is something that we've seen here as well. The Golden Dawn, a very vicious party. Nate, what were your thoughts on this sort of coming out party by the Golden Dawn after their electoral success, where they're just basically openly saying they're Nazis?
Well, I mean, I think it's great. You know, just got to show your true colors. I'm just looking at a picture of here, one of their flags. Just kind of looks like half of a swastika. So, you know, just wearing it loud and proud. Also, a lot of good quotes here in this Guardian article I'm reading of various Golden Dawn supporters. Let's not forget all the gays and the Jews, and he did not say gays. The wankers who control the banks, the foreigners who are behind them, who came in and Greece. I don't care that 6 million Jews died. What does that have to do with my paycheck and the job that I lost? So, just sort of your typical rhetoric of a right-wing party. I mean, first of all, the whole comparison with like the Holocaust, the never-ending taxes that I'm forced to pay, the criminals rule this country, the anger I carry inside, blah, blah, blah. I mean, okay, first of all, what does that have to do with anything? I think we're getting an insight into why the ADL and, I mean, we have our problems with the ADL, but they found that Greece was at 69% to be the most anti-Semitic country in Europe. And, I mean, I don't know if those numbers are 100% accurate, but I doubt it's too far off.
It's a clear callousness, certainly, at minimum, which is just, as that quote shows, it's foreigners, it's various endangered minorities of various, ethno-religious or orientation, any of those factors. These are legitimate threats, being made. This is a party that has committed violence at the highest levels against people they disagree with. This is a very dangerous ideology that they've endorsed, and they clearly don't care that they're embraced. They understand that they're embracing a party that caused the Holocaust, and they do not care.
Yeah, I mean, their candidate for the mayor of Athens sports a swastika tattoo and apparently assaulted two left-wing female politicians during a live TV show, which is a good look. They're apparently connected to the murder of a anti-fascist rapper who was murdered at the hands of a self-confessed party cadre member. So basically just, I guess, someone went off on their own and killed some random person who was opposed to their politics.
Right. And I think they've had a lot of issues of them having a lot of guns.
Yeah. Oh, well, obviously.
One of the big problems that we've seen from this Golden Dawn party is that they seem to think that the problems, again, there's a lot of problems in Europe, especially within the populist frame, of not really understanding who's to blame for the problems that they're facing on their end, like at the kind of the end user end in the street, the person on the street. How does what's happening affect them? Where is that ultimately coming from? The Golden Dawn response is to blame the Jews or the banks or the foreigners. And the Greek left, the Greek quote unquote radical left, which doesn't seem all that radical in comparison to the radical right here. Their position is, no, the problem is austerity measures that are being enforced without really considering the consequences, sort of a failure to understand how these policies are going to translate, punishing average people for the mistakes of their leaders or for past debt manipulations and things like that, which were problems, but this is not necessarily the solution. And the problem is then these cuts are very painful and they radicalize segments of the population who then blame the wrong people in some cases, rather than realizing where the ultimate problem lies. One of the examples that we get is the Golden Dawn railing against tax evasion by foreigners. That's one of their planks that was mentioned in the article that Nate was quoting from The Guardian. They say that the problem of Greece's debt situation and all that is that the quote-unquote foreigners in Greece are not paying their taxes and are evading their taxes. This is, as far as I can tell, the silliest thing that has ever been said on the topic of Greek tax evasion, because as has been widely documented by some fairly intense investigative journalism from around the world, Greece has a very, very serious problem with tax evasion at an epidemic, pervasive, citizen-wide level. This is not a problem limited to their ultra-rich. This is not a problem limited to the organized religion. This is not a problem limited to the foreigners. This is a problem that, yes, does involve pretty much all of those populations, but only because it affects everyone. Almost everyone in Greece, as far as we've been able to figure out, evades paying their taxes. And you might say, oh, well, this means the tax burden is too high. And indeed, Greece does have a very high tax burden by percentage. But that tax percentage has only gone up because the Greek government can't figure out how to collect the taxes they've already imposed. So they're just hoping that if they keep ratcheting it up, that more money will come in by people saying, okay, well, I'm not going to pay the full whatever percent, but I'll pay that percentage minus a bunch. And that's probably not going to work either. But Greece has a very serious tax evasion problem, and that's how they ended up having all this debt situation. And then the European Union not being very flexible on the debt situation causes a very vicious cycle here. But it's not foreigners who are the problem in Greece. It's that there's a epidemic level of tax evasion going on and a clear lack of people making a connection between the money that I put in is the services that I get out. So if I put money in and I want to get paid, or I want to keep these generous benefits, or I want these basic health services, because it's not just a, you know, generous overpayment, it's also the basics that have been taken away. If you don't pay in, you don't get these things out. If you want them, you got to pay in. And that, you know, I hate to sound like I'm lecturing here, but when it comes down to people then translating this into blaming foreigners and minorities and embracing Nazis, that's a problem where the rest of the world is going to want to start stepping in and being a little bit condescending.
In this Guardian article, there's also an interesting quote from Dimitris Passaris, who is the author of the Black Bible of Golden Dawn, which is a interesting a book about, you know, sort of their growth in the past, or in recent years, and exploring their history. He says, Greece's deep cultural differences with the rest of Europe after the Second World War, it did not undergo real democratization because we had civil war, 46 to 49. And after that, the deep state was never really purged of extreme right-wing elements. Even when it was a small group, Golden Dawn had ties to the Greek state. And they fielded retired generals. They have military ties. I mean, we're talking about a group that just shares a lot of the similarities to, I mean, they would be right at home during the Civil War era times, you know, when you just had fascist remnant parties fighting with, you know, communist parties and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, we see these kind of deep state elements in places like Turkey, which, you know, periodically has a military uprising against the democratic government. There are just all these ties in a lot of these countries. I mean, we're seeing examples, obviously, with the two I just mentioned, but there are, of course, many other examples around the world where there are these extreme right-wing groups, many of which, you know, sort of were founded in an extremely different time where basically coup d'etats were almost, you know, just expected, common, this sort of just what happened at a certain point. And, you know, now they've sort of tried to stick their toes into the democratic process. And of course, they're not really suited for it. So they go about with these mass demonstrations and get involved in guns and murder and all sorts of stuff like that. So, you know, we're just seeing a very worrying rise across Europe of these types of parties. And even in countries where you don't necessarily think you'd see a right-wing movement, you know, Denmark recently, there was a strong showing for the Danish People's Party, which is kind of, I wouldn't say it's quite to the level of Golden Dawn in terms of outright embrace of Nazism.
Right, but it's very nationalist, but, and, it won first place.
Anti-immigrant, I haven't heard any particular racial rhetoric, but probably anti-Muslim immigrant, anti-brown foreigners in general. I mean, it's in every country. So it's really disheartening to see. But I mean, I guess it's to be expected. There's a lot of racial problems in Europe that in some ways we don't have in the US, or they're sort of more under the surface.
There are problems, but they're a different set of problems.
Yeah. And of course, not saying the US is, in any way, shape or form free of any sort of racial problems, but, it's kind of a different situation just in terms of how people have responded to just the introduction of more and more non-white, immigrants, and whether their culture is able to sustain that type of influx that we found is entirely possible in the US, because we've been doing it for, 300-400 years, something like that. We've done okay.
Right. Although on the other hand, these other countries, many of them got their independence and formed their concept of a nation state as, you know, those two concepts, the state being the territorial and governmental entity, and then the nation being the group of people within it. And that the concept of the nation, in contrast with the American concept of the nation, the concept of the nation in Europe was very ethno-linguistically centered. I mean, that was obviously a big factor in the Balkan conflicts of the 1990s, but it goes way back much longer than that, which is this idea of, can the idea of the nation state survive an influx of outsiders if those outsiders cannot be merged into the dominant ethnicity? Because if your concept of who we are is ethnically based, that's going to present problems eventually.
Yeah, I mean, and they're just going to have to be flexible if they, you know, have any hope of maintaining that type of a concept as a nation, because, I mean, I think language can and should be an important to concept as a nation, but I don't think, you know, where your great-great-grandparents were born necessarily has to be. I think it's it is entirely possible to assimilate immigrants. And the question is, you know, is there a willingness to do it? Is there, you know, what is the response of the immigrants? Are they, you know, just maintaining their own customs? Are they, you know, eagerly embracing the customs of the state to which they've immigrated? So,
which they're probably not likely to do if they're not feeling very
exactly,
welcome.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's a two-way street. And we've talked about this many times in the U.S. as well. But, of course, in the U.S., the vast majority of immigrants eagerly embrace many aspects of American culture. And then you have a lot of people on the right, you know, complaining, oh, they speak Spanish sometimes and therefore they're not assimilated. Yeah, they speak Spanish maybe at home with their grandparents that, you know, never learned English, but I guarantee you most immigrants that come to the U.S. learn English very quickly. So, I mean, that just what has to happen. And, you know, this is a much more recent phenomenon in Europe. So they're way far behind the U.S. when it comes to dealing with the situation. So if you read U.S. history, you see just, and Bill talked about the know-nothings a little bit earlier in the show, you just see constant examples of our own struggles with this, and that continues today. So it's certainly not going to be easy, and it's not going to be quick, but hopefully we will not have too many more Golden Dawn-type parties getting, you know, actual votes, which is really scary.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you for joining me again here on Arsenal for Democracy to offer your insights on these various topics we've hit this week. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment, so stick around. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Europe right now is my friend Etienne, and he just wrote a big article for us on arsenalfordemocracy.com about the recent European elections. Etienne, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
So you are speaking to us from France, and yeah. France had an unusual election result for the recent European elections. These were the elections to the European Union Parliament, and in France, the voters voted about 25% or a quarter of the vote went to the Front National, and this was also mirrored in a number of other countries. But why don't we just start with France? What was the big significance of that development there? Why is this making all the headlines?
I think the point is there is a big crisis of the political system. So, you know, today French completely mistrust their politicians. So François Hollande has a very low popularity. And so today Nicolas Sarkozy wants to come back, but opinion polls show that he is not popular at all too. There are several scandals, like the conflict of leadership in the UMP, and in the Parti Socialiste, there is the scandal about the former Minister of Budget, Cahuzac. And so now, even after the European election, there is a big Malian scandal, which is a pretty big scandal too. So I think that French sees that that the policies don't make good results, and there is scandals. It's why they don't trust in the two big political parties.
Right.
And so the Front National is taking the results of the rest of the French people.
So as you said, the socialist president is unpopular. The UMP president before him is also unpopular. Those are the two mainstream parties. So people are trying to turn to a different party. And perhaps in the past they might have voted for the Communist Party, but that's pretty much gone at this point for the most part. So they're turning in a completely different direction. This isn't the first time, though, that this party has taken people by surprise, right? Because in 2002... They made it to the second round of the presidential election, correct?
Yeah, 2002 was a real shock. Everybody was surprised because opinion polls show that Jospin, the socialist candidate, would be in the second round. So yeah, it was a really big shock. It was in the presidential election. The presidential election in France is the most important election, like in the USA. And so now far-right party was at the second round. After the first round, there was a lot of demonstration, but now we have the impression that we are going back to 2002. It's like that, so nothing has changed.
The party seems to have tried to put on a more moderate face, but people were still very surprised, I think, or a little concerned or worried that the Front National had won the elections for the EU this year, because it's not as important as the presidential election, but it's still very significant that this party took first place. Now, tell us a little bit about what the Front National party stands for. Why is it that it's so concerning to people that they are winning elections now?
So the Front National is strongly against immigration. The FN wants to close the border. It's against the European Union. They are against free trade with other European countries. So they want protectionism, and they want also death penalty, which was abolished. It's ambiguous now with Marine Le Pen. Jean-Marie Le Pen was clearly pro-life. Marine Le Pen is talking more about economic issues. She is not talking about abortion, really. So the FN is also against gay marriage. That's clear, yeah. One other proposition of the Front National is in French, the préférence nationale, or in English, national preference. So when there is a stranger and when there is a French, if the two people apply for the same job, the French one must have the job.
So this would be the opposite of affirmative action policies in the United States, where the majority is not preferred. In this case, it would be saying that the French-born person gets priority over the foreign immigrant.
It's exactly that. And so, you know, in the French far right, there is a popular issue, which is the anti-right racism. Marine Le Pen don't say it clearly, but when you hear her, you understand. So to illustrate that, one example. She often says that French people recognize in the streets that there is a lot of immigrant people. In fact, when you see people on the street, you know, if he's a stranger, he's an immigrant person. So what that means, in fact, if you can recognize that person is an immigrant, does not look like French people. In fact, they are not white.
Right. So that essentially, in American terms, is basically that they're unassimilated, that they are non-white, and that they're somehow uniquely recognizable, which means that even though she's not explicitly being racist, she's making a coded reference.
Yes, a coded reference. It's exactly that. Yeah.
Yes, this is what we call in U.S. politics a dog whistle, where you don't say it explicitly, but the people who are supposed to hear the message understand what it actually means.
Yeah, exactly. The Front National is a master in this topic. They are professional to do that.
Right. Now, this is not something that was a trend that was limited to France, which is why these European elections have been so significant. Now, the European elections, as you noted in your article on arsenalfordemocracy.com, are basically they're elected by each country, but they elect a certain number of members of parliament to the European Parliament, which gets to frame the laws that are proposed by the European Commission. And some of the people in there are from the mainstream parties, whether it's the Socialist Party or the Labour Party or the Democratic Party of this country or the Conservative Party of that country. But some of them are these sort of more fringe parties, or now less fringe than they used to be. And so in France, it's the FN. In Denmark, it was, I believe, the FPP or something. They also won the nationwide European elections in Denmark. And then in the United Kingdom, the UKIP, or as they say there, UKIP, which is the United Kingdom Independence Party. So now what's the difference between the United Kingdom Independence Party, which is sort of classified as a Eurosceptic populist party, versus the nationalist populist parties like the FN in France?
They don't have the same origin. To understand, the Front National has been founded by fascist people. One friend of Jean-Marie Le Pen was Tixier Vignancourt. Tixier Vignancourt worked with Vichy, the fascist regime during the Second World War. Tixier Vignancourt was a lawyer after the war, and he defended all the persons who collaborated with the fascist regime. And so a lot of persons who formed the Front National were involved in the OAS, the secret organization army, which defended the French Algeria against the French state, against the independence. So it's clearly fascist. There are clearly links with the far right, and the UKIP doesn't have the same story at all. behind the UK IEP, there is a Freedom Association. The Freedom Association is a like Tea Party. It's the same ideology. They are libertarian about economic issues and conservative on the other issues. And so there is links with the far right because the Freedom Association was against the boycott of South Africa during apartheid. But it's not the same story at all. So the Front National is racialist. For the Front National, a person of North Africa would have a lot of difficulties to live in France because it's not the same culture. For the UKIP, there is not this problem. The UKIP said that immigration is a problem in the UK because the United Kingdom government can't control its borders itself. And so the government should be able to control the borders. And so for them, the problem of immigration is mainly economics. And moreover, the UKIP is for free trade. The UKIP supports TAFTA. The Front National is protectionist. The Front National is against TAFTA. So it's not the same ideological roots.
Right, it's a different ideology that they have different views on economics and racial things, and the ultimate result is that they have some level of opposition to the European Union and membership in it for their countries, but the reasons are different and the extent to which they oppose it is different.
Yeah, the UKIP is for the free trade zone in Europe. The Front National is against it.
Now, what do you think is going to be the result of this? Is the first time that that another party has won an election in Britain, a national election, even if it was for the European elections. This is the first time in over a century. What kind of pressure is this going to put on David Cameron's government and specifically his Conservative Party?
David Cameron already promised a referendum about the European Union membership after 2017, so only if he was re-elected. And so the main threat is that he could propose this referendum during the actual mandate. So, you know, the Conservative Party is very ambiguous about European Union. Economic interest told to the Conservative Party to stay in the European Union. So the Conservative Party is in the middle. The Lib Dem and the Labour wants to stay. The UKIP wants to be out. And so the Conservative Party is now in the middle, and the main threat that the Conservative Party could shift closer to the UKIP by proposing a referendum, I think.
Right. But so this puts pressure on Cameron to balance, even more pressure on balancing the sort of UKIP leaning section of his own party that's very opposed to the European Union versus the business interests, the mainstream business interests in the party that favor continued membership in the European Union and are more aligned with the position of Labour and the Liberal Democrats. But this could make him push up the referendum to within this term instead of to the next term.
But now, I want to add one thing.
Right,
you know,
sure.
In Greece, the radical left, Syriza, took the first place. Moreover, I think with the Podemos seats, or even Benjamin in Slovenia, and other parties like that, the United European Left group. And so I think that the progression of the European Left was not very discussed. It's a very important factor. In Ireland, in Portugal, in Spain, in Greece, it's exploded.
And as you said, in countries like Greece or various other countries, although that the populist parties, whether they were far right or fascist or Eurosceptic, only in a few countries did they actually come in first, whereas the left tended to come in first in places like Italy, for example, or in Spain and Portugal, and the radical left coming in first in Greece. So as you said, it hasn't been discussed as much, but although the center right lost a lot of seats, they weren't all to the far right. Some of them were going to the center left or the far left, but the center left seemed to do very well in these elections, which I think is an interesting sign.
Yeah, it was. I think that the main point it was that this European Parliament election confirmed the decline of liberals and centrists first, which had been losing seats since 15 years ago, and the European Popular Party stay the first party, but it is really weakened.
Right, they lost 51 seats, even though they still came in first overall in the European-wide elections.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, Etienne, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about the developments that we've seen in Europe in the last couple of weeks and why these are so important.
Thank you, Bill. I was glad to tell you about this subject.
You can hear more on this topic of European populism and ultranationalism at arsenalfordemocracy.com. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.